Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week. I'm your host, Hank Sanders. Each week, we tackle a different issue that's uniquely Portland. So tune in every Saturday to hear a new episode complete with interviews and editorial that helps explain our city. From Portland's leading paper comes a brand new way to engage with the news, sports, arts, and culture. Stick around. Welcome to the Dive Podcast. Today is August 14th, and you are listening to the 33rd episode. Thank you so much for joining us today. In this episode, we are no longer doing a special guest like we've been doing for a long time, but we are returning back to our shows that we love doing, and that is covering Portland news, and more specifically, diving deep into the Willamette Week cover stories that we have for you every single Wednesday. So talking to the reporter Tess Risky, who co-wrote this story with editor Aaron Mesh, we will get into that story, get into that interview in a little bit. But first, all the headlines, all the news that happened this week. This is the 90-second news flash. First off, the Oregon governor race is already kicking off, and multiple people have reportedly been throwing their names in the hat. The most notable name that is feeling out whether or not to run for the highest position in the state is New York Times journalist Nick Kristof. However, this run, or potential run, is triggering questions of residency because Oregon law says that you must live in Oregon for 3 years before you run, which may dash Kristof's hopes due to the fact that he has lived in places other than Oregon, including New York and all around, but Oregon residency might be a problem for him. While he was born and raised in Oregon, he might not be able to pass those restrictions. Do you recall Recall PDX? I know it's a little bit of a pun there, but Recall PDX was the group that was going to be responsible for recalling Mayor Ted Wheeler from office. But this group might be in trouble because they've only received 1/8 the number of signatures that they need to receive in order to put their proposition of recalling the mayor onto the ballot. So we will keep you updated with that story, but it's not looking too great for them as they struggle to get those signatures. The big news this week comes from Governor Kate Brown. I'm sorry to say, but it is time to dust off those masks, dig them out of your pocket, put them right back into your life, because we have a mask mandate in indoor situations here in Portland, Oregon. So I know I hate masks, but hey, I'm just here to follow orders. I guess the Delta variant and unvaccinated people have made this dangerous for us, so who knows? But I guess it's a mask mandate. It's been back into action today, actually Friday, so you should be well aware of that. But that's the big story, and those are the big stories. So this has been the 90-second News Flash. We turn now to our main story. The topic of today's show revolves around the cover story written this week by editor Aaron Mesh and reporter Tess Risky. Before we get to our interview with Tess, let me give you a quick rundown of what the piece is about. With businesses shuttered for a year and a half in downtown Portland and people pushing for slashes to be made to the Portland police budget, one of the police force teams that saw the most trimming was the team that patrols the downtown late night life. So the bars and restaurants that operate in midnight and past in downtown Portland. The reduction of surveillance in this area at this time has led to bars and restaurants to turn to private security teams to protect their patrons late at night. This story covers these private security groups and discusses the issues surrounding these security companies. With that, let's turn to the tape of our interview with Tess Risky. Hope you enjoy. Okay, Tess, thank you so much for joining us. And let's start with this. So when I was reading your article, there was one quote that I came across that where we're going to start with today. And that quote, it was with a person that you interviewed who was a security guard, a private security guard, not a police force member. And his quote was as follows. I'm reading it right here. Quote, "My job is to get you home safe unless you're the perpetrator, the shooter, potentially. The only way for evil to succeed is for good men to do nothing," unquote. So this statement reminds me of a kind of a debatable topic, a controversial line that's often used by people who support gun rights and support carrying arms freely. And that's the only thing that can stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Does that have merit? Because as I'm reading this, it does seem like they are the defense mechanism, the de facto militia or police force that these companies are using.
You know, it's really tricky when it comes to a nightlife setting, like the story is talking about, because, you know, I've heard that argument too, that people have made of, you know, a good guy with a gun can stop a bad guy with a gun. And as far as that argument goes, you know, I'm neither here nor there on like whether or not that has merit. But in terms of the nightlife setting in particular, it's really interesting because a lot of the bar owners I interviewed had differing thoughts on this, because it's a unique situation for two main reasons. First, people tend to be intoxicated and therefore, you know, potentially rowdier, have lower inhibitions or less poorer decision-making skills, I would say. And then second, you know, it's just crowded, like physically crowded, whether you're indoors or outside, there are a lot more literal people around. So part of the concern, from what I understand, of having firearms in that setting, it's unique beyond just, you know, other settings, because of, you know, the potential for people to overreact. And then on top of that, like, you have so many like bodies in one space. So, you know, if you're shooting at somebody who has a gun too, if you're a security guard who's trying to, like, you know, apprehend a shooter by shooting them, are you inside a crowded bar where there are a bunch of other people packed in there? And then are you going to hit them too, potentially? Are you trained to shoot as accurately as, say, a police officer is trained to shoot?
I can imagine how difficult it would be if an active shooter came into a nightclub with hundreds of bodies very close together, and there's a guy with an AK-47 who's the good guy, I guess. How is he going to stop that person and not kill other people, you know, bystanders? So when you talk to these people, did you game out those scenarios and ask them what will happen if a shooter comes into the building? Or was their opinion more just like, well, a shooter won't come in because they'll see a guy standing out there with four guns on his body?
Right. It was all over the place in terms of the answers. So, you know, the security guards outside of Shake Bar, who are hired by Ravencrest, from my understanding, they had a bit more of a sense. And those are the ones who do carry a rifle. The owner of that company, Corey Webb, who goes by the nickname Ghost, he talked about how, you know, it's kind of more of the visual presence of this weapon is enough to dissuade people. But then that's one take, right? Then we spoke to the owner of a bar, and I really, sorry, I can't remember the name right now. It wasn't featured heavily in the story. It was one of the smaller ones, but he mentioned that he doesn't have an actual like lethal firearm, but he keeps a pellet gun inside of his bar. And then on the other end of the spectrum completely is Dan Lenzen, who's the owner of Dixie Tavern, who we include in the article explaining his rationale. And he's worked in Portland nightlife for like several decades, and he has his own security staff who he trains himself, but they're not armed.
So how much of these companies relying on private police force is a direct response to the reduction in the police force, in the Portland police force, versus just the idea that, hey, if you have a bunch of drunk people in an area in downtown Portland, you're just going to need to have some type of private security. Doesn't matter what the police can do. So what percent of it is based on each category of whether this is police force scaling back or just the way that this goes in nightlife?
A lot of the armed security patrolling the streets of Old Town and Chinatown is new. And so I'll, to explain more of the context, like it's best to rewind to, you know, March of 2020, which is when most businesses in downtown Portland and like, you know, nationwide really shut down.
Yeah.
And then a few months later, we have sort of, you know, the uprisings, you know, following the murder of George Floyd. So you have these racial justice protests that are happening, you know, near the Justice Center, which is not far from the entertainment district where these bars are located. And so that's happening. There's nationwide calls for police reform. In June of last year, the city council removed or cut the police bureau's budget by $15 million. There have been other cuts related to the pandemic, but specifically that amount was coming off of like the call to defund the police bureau. So as a result of that, The police bureau dissolved a unit called the entertainment detail, which it had been staffing officially for 8 years, I believe, because it had been going since 2012 officially and like as an official unit. And that unit consisted of one sergeant and then up to seven officers who would like patrol with that sergeant, build relationships with the bar owners and sort of have like this, what sounds like a community policing style presence in the area. So that was a thing that the bar owners seemed to really enjoy and appreciate and work well with. And then that was dissolved in July of last year, but who's going to really notice, because these bars downtown are still not opening, right? Or if they are, there's sort of, there were some, you know, touch and go openings, you know, that happened. And then it wasn't officially until March of this year, 2021, that a lot of them reopened. Now that created kind of this like vacuum of, okay, so there aren't police. So what do we do? So several of these bars have hired private outside security firms. And so I was speaking to one Portland police captain who used to oversee the entertainment detail. And he says that before this, there was one main security firm in the area that he knew of that isn't really a firm any, they're not really around anymore. And they had like great relationship with that group. And then sometimes there would be a second. So like at most, there were these two security firms that PPB was aware of. And now he says he's seen like maybe five or more. And
wow. And from the photos that you shared in the article, it's a very different vibe seeing these people holding these assault rifles outside in the open who aren't police officers. It's a very different vibe than just seeing like a Ford Explorer with, you know, Portland police written on it driving around, which would do the same thing to deter people, right? You're not going to, you know, shoot up anything if you see a police officer right there. And so it really does feel like something that, you know, I don't know how I feel about it. And it really did make me think back to when last summer people were really talking about defunding the police. But now when I read this article, it's like any budget that you trim from the police budget really has repercussions on the Portland economy. Did this article change your view on how we should be funding police officers?
It's tricky to take this article and apply it to how police should be funded, because I'm really generalizing here, but one of the main arguments for reducing funding of the Portland Police Bureau is that they have over-policed many communities, right? They've over-policed communities of color, specifically Black communities in Portland. They've over-policed people with mental health issues. They've unnecessarily escalated situations specifically with communities of color and people, you know, who are experiencing homelessness or mental health crises. And they have, you know, a massive budget. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but, you know, even the amount that they did have reduced was a fraction of their overall budget, right?
Right.
It's not like they were defunded.
A in quarter, the right. Board. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so the problem is that, you know, people are have been concerned for decades, not just, you know, since 2020, that there's a lack of accountability with police, right? That when they shoot somebody who's unarmed, for example, there isn't recourse, there aren't repercussions. That person isn't fired, let alone ever charged or convicted of the crime. That hasn't been fixed yet. Like, those problems all still exist.
Right.
Now, enter these private security firms. They have even less, significantly less accountability than police, though. So it's like, that's why it's hard for me to say, oh, yeah, this is an argument for funding Portland Police Bureau, because it, to me, is, it's kind of apples and oranges.
If there were to be a shooting and one of these private security guards went in and intervened, is the police force worried that when they get called into the scene, they won't know who's the active shooter and who's the private police force member?
Heard that exact concern, but
the in the article they expressed the concern of people not knowing who's a police, right? And who's not. I wasn't sure if it was
as
well.
So the concern I heard from police was less of we won't be able to know who's kind of like the, again, quote unquote, good guy here, right? Or
right.
Who's the bad guy. And they do have a communication with each other. You can see when you're out there that the police and these security officers are talking to each other. Police that are roaming the area are going up and saying hello to the like armed security guards. So they know each other a little bit, at least they should be able to recognize a uniform, hopefully, you know, but again, there's no like uniform requirements. You don't know that, but the concern I heard from police was like, we don't know the training level of these guys. Like, yeah, we know they're hopefully DPSST certified, but like, you know, that's 38 hours of training, you know, it's so, you know, I mean, first of all, I think the police are worried, like, are all of these guys DPSST certified? You don't even know that. They might not be. Second of all, like, is that they underwent more training by choice than the minimum requirement. Hopefully they've opted to do more work than that. But it's the concern of like, you know, these guys have high powered weapons, which are legal. I'm not suggesting there's anything illegal about what the security firms are doing. But it's just like, you know, I think police are like, you know, the concern is that these security guards maybe don't know what they're doing. And that's a tricky thing to say, because a lot of people will argue that police's tactics are like inherently overreactive or can escalate situations too. So some people might say, well, is that the kettle calling the pot black, right? Like, you know, how is a cop with a gun better than a security guard with a gun, maybe? But I think a lot of that answer might come down to like the accountability aspect and like the incident reporting aspect. And the fact that, you know, if somebody isn't in a uniform, in a PPB uniform, you know, they went through a certain like level of training. They are employed by the city of Portland. They had to pass their psychological exam, all of that. And like, maybe that means nothing, but it does feel like something a little bit more than security.
Yeah, maybe increasing the amount of people who have AK-47s and aren't members of police officers, maybe that doesn't make us all safer in the long run. So that's an interesting, it's super interesting that this topic was covered by you guys, because it's not something I've really considered, you know, what goes into these private police forces that have popped up more than ever in Portland. Speaking of, you just talked about something in that answer that, you know, you didn't have enough words and enough time to go into. Tell us another thing that, had you been given no time limit, a year to do this story, 15 stories, what's another avenue you'd like to go on but couldn't because of the time constraints?
I mean, I really wish I had more time to interview the actual customers of these bars and to ask, you know, do you feel safer with these guys outside than you would with police versus than you would with nobody, right? Like, what would you prefer? Would you prefer no security or police? Would you prefer security over police or vice versa? And why? Do you feel less safe? Do you feel more safe? Can you tell them apart from cops? Does any of that matter to you?
Yeah.
You know, like, do you care even? I wish I was able to ask more. And I was out there till after last call on Friday doing reporting. I can tell you, Aaron went many more nights than I did. I think he went like 4 or 5 nights down there.
Wow. But
I only did one, and I just wish I did more of speaking to people, because I think that's kind of what's missing, is a lot of the stories from the standpoint of the business owners who said like, yeah, this is a huge problem. We want more police in this area. Instead, we've had to hire these guys, but there isn't really much from the customers, who also are young people, right? And a lot of these bars, the customers are young people of color. And I think they would have a different perspective on the police presence than, you know, some of the bar owners.
You and Aaron obviously co-wrote this article. How did you break up? Who did what?
I think I took more of the lead on the police and DPSST reporting. And then Aaron took more of the lead on like the nightlife scenes and the business owners angle.
Okay, finishing up here, there was one quote in the article that I perked up a little bit when I read it, and a guy was talking about how he wouldn't do this work unless he was getting paid a king's ransom, which he implied that he was. Did you get a number on how much these security guards make, or security firms make?
No, I did not. I wish we got that too. But that was Corey Webb, the AKA Ghost, who owns Ravencrest security firm. No, I didn't get a number on how much they make. And I don't have a sense of that, of what the pay actually is. So
yeah, I don't know yet.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Aaron was one about that quote, and was probably asking him a lot about that. I don't know what a king's ransom equates to in security guard salary, but you know, I have no clue. Grateful for the little things I love. Early morning light and you. Don't think about the goodbye stuff. Remember someday might come soon. Some days when I wanna hold your hand.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Dive Podcast. We will see you next week for episode 34. Until then, take care, stay safe, and have some fun. For Willamette Week, I'm Hank Sanders. See you Saturday. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week. For more information on this podcast or the biggest stories in Portland, go to wweek.com and follow Willamette Week on all socials. We're doing some really cool things related to the podcast on our Instagram and Twitter. It includes giveaways, behind the scenes, etc. A lot of cool things coming your way, so give those a follow. Special thanks to our guests for joining us, and thank you to Aaron Mesh, Mark Zussman, and Brian Panganibon, as well as the entire Willamette Week family. Last but not least, thank you so much to Heather Witte and AmpMusic.co for the music that you hear on this podcast. For Willamette Week, I'm Hank Sanders. This has been the Dive Podcast.